CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
And now here's your host, Carrie Baptist.
Good evening. In the news this week, we'll be speaking with AMS President Blake Frederick about a turbulent week in AMS politics. It's been 25 years since the Bhopal disaster. We hear from Don Wright of Amnesty International about the human rights situation 20 years on. We also hear from Amy Goodman speaking out about invasive Olympic security measures she faced when she spoke in Vancouver last week. We'll have all this, plus arts, sports, and your weekend weather forecast coming up this hour right here on News 101. First off, this past Wednesday, a packed student council meeting saw student council pass several motions designed to censor AMS President Blake Frederick and VP External Tim Chu. This is the only the latest episode in a saga that was tipped off by Blake and Frederick filing a human rights complaint over UBC tuition rates. Last week at the special meeting, the council unanimously called for Chu and Frederick's resignations. However, Chu and Frederick have decided not to step down. We have Blake Frederick in studio with us tonight to discuss the UN complaint, his decision not to resign, and the concerns that have been raised by the AMS Council and students. Here to interview him is Yassine Karaga.
Thank you very much, my friend. You welcome UBC President Mr. Frederick Blake to have just this chance with us at this evening. There are allegations between you, your government and the University of British Columbia, management and other students in general, regarding to tuition increment or tuition, just that there are some increase in tuition is too high, and that one, we heard that you signed like petition, you are inviting United Nations to intervene. Right now, we are thinking that today would have been with maybe a lot of battalions from United Nations surrounded UBC. They were looking for UBC president, UBC management, and those involved into increasing tuition payment. Now, we are asking president, what was your objective? Why do you sign that? Why do you invite the United Nations, a big government, to intervene to? Are there any political wrangles between your government internally or between you and Mr. the University of British Columbia president? Can you explain to listeners, students they are listening to? Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Regarding the UN complaint, I know that there's been a lot of confusion around what the intent of filing such a complaint was. And I want to state clearly that the intent of filing a United Nations complaint on the issue of accessibility to post-secondary education is merely to draw media and public attention to the issues of post-secondary funding and how our students are being supported who want to attend post-secondary education. In this regard, the complaint was actually very successful. We did receive positive media attention across the country, and we have started in part a national dialogue and debate over the price of post-secondary education. I want to also be clear in mentioning that the goal of such a complaint is not to have the United Nations intervene in the functioning of either the BC or Canadian government.
Yeah.
Rather, it is only to draw attention to the fact that Canada is a signatory onto an international covenant where they have committed to making post-secondary education accessible.
Thank you very much. Now, what about internally into the government? Because there is, when I was reading newspapers from UBC Absa, I found just a citation that within your government, association members, they want to impeach you down. They're just enforcing you to resign. And it seems that the president, you still in power because the terms maybe, I don't know the conditions from your constitution, you still in power. Your term is not yet to end. But the committee members, they are saying that no, he should go. the president should go. We want to. What do you talk about it?
Yeah, there's two separate issues here. There's one of the issue of tuition and what we should say about that. The other is the issue of what process we followed before filing the complaint. Now, on the issue of process, it's been made quite clear to me by both counsel and students at large that the process undertaken before filing the complaint was not consultative enough. Yeah. In the sense that we didn't approve a formal motion from our council and we didn't consult with students at large. And based on the feedback I received, I've both Tim and myself have apologized for not taking another route, taking a different route than we did. With regards to the call that council has made to ask Tim and I to resign, our feeling there is that there are students on both sides of this issue. There are students who feel very strongly that Tim and I should resign from our positions, and there are students who also feel very strongly that we are playing a very prominent successful role on council, and they don't want us to resign. So what we think is more appropriate, rather than council voting to remove or not, is to bring the question to students whether or not they would like to see Tim and I continue in such a role. And this is something that is a principle of democracy. Yeah. Those who elect you are the ones that get to unelect you.
Yeah, thank you very much. President, there are still other questions just regarding the same issue, that there are different steps as you, the president of the Association of Students, about 4,000 students, you have other objective steps you would have talked before signing, inviting United Nations, like negotiating with the school management, UBC staff members or management in concern, especially you can meet with the your colleague, the president of UBC, and you talk about you discuss the matter before you maybe sent it out of the public. Now, we and other students, they are not convinced. How can you convince them? Have you ever took some steps, negotiations before inviting United Nations and human rights to intervene in?
Yeah, so certainly the United Nations complaint is not an isolated lobbying tool, but rather it has been the follow-up to many different methods used this year. This year we met up with a number of candidates during the provincial election and had candidates from all parties sign a pledge to commit to greater post-secondary funding. We ran a public campaign during the election. We registered 500 new voters. We held all candidates debates in the sub. We've met with ministers in government as well as opposition critics. We've also collected signatures on 1,500 postcards calling for restoration and funding to student aid programs that have been cut. Unfortunately, what we see is that without a mass of public pressure behind these kind of funding issues, the government shows an unwillingness to act. And I think you're seeing that across all different portfolios in the government right now, where we have arts being cut and people, you know, protesting and making noise over that. And I feel very strongly that as students, we have to act in a similar way. There is work that can be done by sitting down at the table with elected officials and trying to work some things out. Yeah. But a lot of it does come down to public pressure. And as students, we have to speak out in a very public and loud way in order to get what we need.
Thank you, President. But still, they are saying, get your government members, committee members, the executive members, the university students, they are saying that no, the sovereign has misused his power to go and invite just big organizations like to just call people to intervene in. He misused his responsibility, his position as the president of Students Union at UBC, just to act without our knowledge about it. Have you ever met students by faculty members? You consult them, hearing their problems. Do they complain about fees increment? And was it the right step, that one, to go and fight that? The action which you took.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the majority of students at this university struggle to cover the cost of their education. You know, as the student union, I think it is our role to stand up for those students. And I don't think that the AMS has been doing enough of that in previous years. And one of the reasons why I wanted to come into the AMS as this position is to be an advocate, a very strong and loud advocate for the issues around the financial barriers to post-secondary education. And that's what I've tried to do in my term. Recently with the UN complaint, obviously, I should have gone about that in a different way. I still believe that UN complaint itself is a good tool to raise public awareness, but obviously I should have made sure to consult more broadly before using that tool.
But you believe that maybe you misused the power as a president. You didn't consult the subject, because those who behind you, they are saying, no, we didn't how did you just invite people to come here? Or if maybe we invaded without our knowledge, even the university would have been invaded, maybe calling us criminal people who are violating human rights. The president did something wrong. The subject, the one who was saying that. And then you say you are an advocate, of course. So there are contradictions which we want you to make clear to the general public, that I did this without your knowledge, but I is as power of the sovereign to do it. It was my responsibility. Was it like that, or...?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't actually like that. Both Tim and I did raise the issue through our committee. We did get sign off through our committee system. But in the end, it's been shown to us that that was not enough, and we should have brought it to students at large. And we were wrong in not doing that.
Thank you, President. Before handing over to Megan, we just wanted maybe to highlight, to enlighten the public, the students, about a few words regarding to what are the objectives of student your government since you came in power.
Oh, sure. As the AMS does a lot more than just lobbying, and I know that's the issue that's been highlighted recently, but we do also run the Student Union Building. We run a number of businesses. We provide support for our clubs. We give free bookings in the sub. We administer the U-Pass to our students, so it's not just lobbying. There's certainly a lot more to the AMS, and you know, if there are students who have been disillusioned by this lobbying effort, certainly there are other ways to get involved in the organization as well.
Thank you, sir. And I would say, just besides me, you see Megan, she's our colleague here. She's very ready. Just think that the time President will come here, I have lots of questions which I want to ask him, and I want the clear answer if it's possible. So Megan is here.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you if you think that this effort to ask you to step down has to do with other issues, or if it's just, if they're using this as a kind of... something, just an example that of larger things that they have a problem with, rather than it's actually about the one issue.
Certainly some of it is politically motivated. Mm-hmm. So there have been members of council who have been trying to get rid of me since I was first elected, just on the basis of what my politics are, and you know, that's okay. That's the environment that we're working in the student government, but it is not limited to just that. So you know, and that's been made clear by the fact that the motion for recall was unanimous. But I do know that the kind of approach that I've taken this year with regards to relationship with the university, not everyone has agreed with, and that would probably play into this decision.
How do you think you'll be able to move forward, given the current climate on the council? Do you think that you can maintain a working relationship? Yes.
Yes, I'm trying to move forward in a positive and constructive way. I'm a bit disappointed that council doesn't seem willing to have an open dialogue or conversation on this issue. So on our last Wednesday meeting, I was about to address the UN issue to council, and they abruptly voted to adjourn, which was a clear signal that they do not want Tim or I speaking on this issue, and they've already made up their minds that they want to get rid of us. Which is disappointing, because we haven't had our chance yet to address council and give our account of the UN complaint or the chance to try to build the trust there and move forward for the rest of the term.
Okay, well, thanks for coming and speaking with us tonight.
Thank you.
That was AMS President Blake Frederick. It's now time for some public service announcements. But stay tuned for more local and campus news. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you very much.
Show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite.
Indeed.
Dunkin's Donuts, serving sweet treats from the Pop Underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
At Dunkin' Donuts, each and every
radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite.
Indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the Pop Underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
About the birds and the bees? Want to learn more about the birds and the bees and the berries, urban agriculture, delicious homegrown food, solar energy, and much more? Check out the Society Promoting Environmental Conservation. Come to one of our workshops, join our solar panel tour, or go to our website www.spec.bc.ca for more information.
Hey, we're J plus J plus J, and I bet you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
The sitar.
We call it that. Do you?
You should. Unless you don't like sitars.
Hi, this is Mitch from UBC Swing Kids reminding you to come out swing dancing with us this fall. We offer lessons, workshops, and social dances in both Lindy Hop and West Coast Swing, two outrageously fun partner dances. Not sure if swing dancing is right for you? Come check out our first week of classes for free on Wednesday, September 30th. You don't need a partner, all you need to bring are your two left feet. This year we have some exciting new classes and workshops, so even if you've taken lessons with us before, make sure to check out what's new by visiting our webpage. You can find it by Googling UBC Swing Kids. That's UBC Swing Kids, your on-campus source for Lindy Hop and West Coast Swing.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:21. November 20th was International Transgender Day of Remembrance, a day to remember discrimination and violence that many transgendered people have faced around the world. Our reporters Elias Omid and Rafi attended a student organization event to mark the day. Here are Elias and Rafi in conversation with participants about what Transgender Day of Remembrance means to them.
I'm here with Cody. Now, Cody, what is your overall impression of the talk this evening?
I thought it was pretty cool because where I'm from, there wasn't really much of a trans community, and so this is like the first kind of trans event that I've been to, so it was pretty awesome to come out here and like hear it and everything. So I thought it was pretty sweet, totally worth it.
Is this a new topic for you, or because there weren't many transgender people in your community?
No, definitely not. So yeah, it's definitely new for me. So like to be kind of introduced to the community, I thought was pretty awesome for sure. From then, a lot of people be like kind of more closed-minded, I guess, about it. I guess, but here people seem a lot cooler with it. So I guess it's becoming more accepted, but I think there's still like a long way to go.
I'm with Heidi now, and I ask her about this presentation, what she thinks first, and if she tells us what is the reaction.
It was a really empowering and informative workshop and speech for me personally. I really enjoyed it because I feel like I want to be a trans ally, but I don't know enough about trans issues, and so it really helped to come and hear someone's personal story.
Okay. Was it the first time you attended in such a meeting?
No, I've attended other trans workshops, trans ally workshops, and trans speakers in the past, but not that many.
Thanks to Elias and Rafi for that coverage. Now it's time to go to Amy Goodman, speaking about her time in Vancouver. As she crossed the border, she was interrogated by Canadian officials, and now she's speaking out about what she considers invasive security measures associated with the upcoming games. So here's Amy Goodman in conversation with CKUT's Tariq Jurobukian.
Welcome back to the Friday Morning After. Joining us on the telephone line right now is Amy Goodman. Amy, how are you this morning?
It's very good to be with you, Tariq.
Thank you very much for taking the time to join us this morning. An incredible news item that caught all of our eyes here in Canada last week. It was the detention of yourself at the Vancouver security paranoia that's surrounding the Olympics.
Well, it really was amazing. It was Wednesday night last week, the night before the U.S. Thanksgiving. We were actually driving through the border from Seattle to Vancouver. I was going to be speaking at the Vancouver Public Library. We were just passing the border. The guards asked for our passports, three of us, me, my editor, Dennis Moynihan. I was on a book tour with my new book, Breaking the Sound Barrier, which is a book of columns. And we drove up to the border, gave the passports. They immediately flagged us. We were pulled into the border facility, and they told me to come to the counter, and they wanted to know what I was going to say at my talk. They wanted my notes, which was really shocking to me. And I said to them that I didn't have notes. I speak extemporaneously. They demanded my notes. I went out to the car, and I got the book. I give the speech based on the columns, and I read excerpts of them, and then I comment on them. And he said, "What will you be talking about?" I said, "Well, I start with the last column, which is actually about Tommy Douglas, pioneered single-payer health care, pioneered universal health care in Canada." He said, "What else? What else?" And I said, "Global warming. What else? The global economic crisis." And that's when he said, "The Olympics? Are you going to be addressing the Olympics?" I didn't know what he was referring to. Mm-hmm. And I said, "You mean when President Obama went to Copenhagen to try to get the Olympics in Chicago?" And he said, "No." And he said, "I'm talking about the Olympics here in Vancouver in 2010. I said, "No, I wasn't planning to. You're denying you're talking about the Olympics. You're saying you're not talking about the Olympics." I said, "All of those things, yeah, I'm not." He was angry. He clearly didn't believe me. He told me to sit down. And then they went through my car with a fine-tooth comb. And they were going through documents. They were, when I went out to check on them, it was pouring rain, but I was very concerned about what was happening. They were on my colleague's laptop. They told me to get back inside. Finally, they came in. They pulled me in a back room. They took a photograph, made four copies of the photograph, same with my two colleagues. They stapled them in documents in our passport. I said I wasn't aware we need a visa. They said, "These aren't visas. They are, quote, control documents." And when I opened them, they said that we had to leave by Friday. We were there Wednesday night, had to leave by Friday. We finally left, got to the talk about, an hour and a half or so late. And I was just completely stunned. Mm. This is not only a violation of freedom of the press, it's a violation of the public's right to know. Because when journalists are detained, when they're threatened, when they're surveilled, when they're monitored, when their notes are gone through, which can compromise their sources, it makes it harder to get out information. And that's a threat to the public, because it's harder for you to get information. As I wrote in my column the next week, it's an Olympic loss for democracy. It is, to say the least, very troubling. I had no idea what he was referring to, and only when I then came into Vancouver and started to talk to people did I understand the kind of crackdown that was going on that this fit into.
Question, Amy, when we say they went through my car with a fine-tooth comb, they...
The border guards, the armed border guards. I have no idea, you know, what their agenda was, why they were so obsessed with the Olympics. At that time, I didn't. Once I came into Vancouver and it became such a big story with all the different radio stations across Canada calling and the newspapers, then that next night we went from the Vancouver Public Library to Victoria, to the University of Victoria. Mm. After the piece on our detention, I saw the piece about the Vancouver City Council having to back off some legislation that they had passed, very draconian, on the issue of carrying of Olympic signs. You can't do it in the area. At that moment, I definitely wasn't planning to. I didn't even know which Olympics they were talking about.
As a journalist, you've been all over the world. Have you ever encountered anything like you encountered from the Canadian Border Security Agents?
I've been to Canada many times, and I've not experienced this.
The Republican National Convention in Minnesota, you and your crew were physically assaulted. I saw a very extensive report on a program called Crashing the Party that you were interviewed on. Do you think that Canada and Vancouver specifically is gearing up for the same sort of overkill as you experienced in Minnesota?
More than 40 reporters were arrested in St. Paul at the Republican National Convention. My colleagues were arrested covering a protest, and I was on the convention floor when that happened, interviewing delegates at the convention. I got a call on my cell phone, heard they had been arrested. I raced off to the area where they were arrested, went up to the police, demanded to speak to a commanding officer to have them freed, and then the police arrested me. So we were among the more than 40 reporters who were arrested at the convention. And again, this is yet another violation. I mean, we have to be able to be free to do our work. We shouldn't have to get a record to put things on the record. We are supposed to go to where the silence is. We're supposed to be covering what's happening on the convention floor, in the corporate suites who's sponsoring these conventions, out in the streets to speak to the uninvited guests who also have something to say. You know, democracy is a messy thing, and we're supposed to cover it all. Mm. And when the state hinders that, it is a violation for everyone.
Is the security surrounding the Vancouver Olympics that you have experienced so far something that leads you to believe that the possibilities of what happened to the 40 reporters and yourself at the Republican National Convention is going to be repeated by the Vancouver security forces?
I certainly can't say. I don't know, but it is of grave concern to see this kind of draconian crackdown. I think this kind of crackdown is a threat to national security. When people feel afraid if they're going to cover something the state doesn't want them to cover, I think dissent is what will save our country. Mm. I think they're the principles on which they were built, and that has to be protected. Thank you so much for covering this, and just for your great station, thanks so much for CKUT.
Thank you for joining us on the phone this morning. Amy Goodman, you can listen to Amy Goodman every single morning here on CKUT from 8 a.m. With the Democracy Now! Headlines, also available on the internet at www.democracynow.org. Her new book, Breaking the Sound Barrier, is out as well and is on the New York Times bestseller list.
That was Host of Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman, in conversation with CKUT's Tariq Jabrookum. We're now going to take a quick break, but stay tuned. Next, we bring you arts, sports, weather, and right after these public service announcements.
Do you like having fun and winning cool prizes? Then you gotta check out the Sustainability Television 2009 Youth Media Contest.
Sustainability Television and the Sierra Club of BC want your creative, fun, and inspiring poems and essays with pictures or videos describing what you're doing to make your community more sustainable.
There are tons of totally rad prizes to be won. In addition to cash prizes, sponsor prizes include a $10,000 25-day river excursion, a recycled PC laptop, passes to Y Yoga and Sempre Viva Yoga, organic grocery delivery from Spud, as well as visits for you and a friend to Whistler's Zip Trek Eco Tours, and much, much more.
The contest runs until January 9th, 2010, but the sooner you enter, the more likely you are to win. Check out sustainabilitytelevision.com for full details. And tell us what you're doing.
Hey, dog, I'm hungry. We got no meat or dairy products in our fridge, dog, and I'm hungry. What are we going to do? Delicious vegan recipes baked fresh every week with your favorite bands on Let's Get Baked with Matt and Dave. It's the finest radio baking program available. Tune in and bake along. You won't be disappointed. Hey, dog, are you hearing this? This is a really good idea, dog.
Mondays from 3 to 4 p.m. on CITR in Vancouver.
Let's get big with Matt and Dave. Eat some good food, too.
Tune in to CITR Friday afternoons from 2 till 3:30 for Radio Zero, where your host DJ brings you an eclectic mix of new international pop, ranging from the most fashionably disaffected to the brightest sugar-coated music around, along with a good measure of vintage new wave, punk, and disco to kick off your weekend. That's Radio Zero, Friday afternoons at 2 on 101.9 FM, CITR.
AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the helpline is one of many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The helpline number is 604-696-4666 or contact us online at www.aidsvancouver.org.
Hey man, this is Big J Magneto. Man, if you want to hear all the great sounds, you got to listen to this cat, man, because this is, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, the greatest sound.
When you experiment with cut-ups over a period of time, you find that some of the cut-ups seem to refer to future events. Well, we went on to exploit the potentials of the tape recorder.
Now, back to modern times.
Tape recorders.
Cut up, slow down, speed up, run backwards, inch the tape. That means work it back and forth across the tape head.
Hey, girls. Move a little closer.
Play several tracks at once. Cut back and forth between two recorders.
Copyright infringement. Piracy.
Oh, no, I pressed the wrong button again.
So cut-ups put you in touch with what you know and do not know that you know.
Exquisite Corpse, Thursday, 7:30 to 9 p.m. on the mighty CITR Radio 101.9, Vancouver.
This is not all rock and roll, dude.
CITR CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, Hotbox, The Kiss Store, Slickety Jim's Chat and Chew, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, The Whip Gallery Restaurant, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free Friends card, and feel the love.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. In international news, it's been 25 years since the Bhopal disaster in India. On December 3rd, 1984, a Yumin carbide pesticide plant located near the city of Bhopal started leaking toxic methyl isocyanide gas. Ultimately, the gas leak killed 10,000 people over a three-day period. For more details on the 25th anniversary, we turn to Stuart and Sylvia Richardson of CJSF in conversation with Don Wright of Amnesty International.
25 years ago, there was the Bhopal disaster. It was one of the largest industrial disasters the planet has ever seen, from the plant Union Carbide pesticide plant in the city of Bhopal. At midnight on December 3rd, 1984, the plant released methane isocyanate, MIC, exposing more than 500,000 people to MIC and other chemicals. The first official immediate death toll was 2,259. The government has confirmed a total of 3,787 deaths related to the gas release. Others estimate 8,000 to 10,000 deaths within 72 hours, and 25,000 have since died from gas-related diseases. Some 25 years after the gas leak, 390 tons of toxic chemicals abandoned at the Union Carbide plant continued to pollute the groundwater in the region, which affect thousands of residents in Bhopal who depend on it. There are currently civic and criminal charges related to the disaster ongoing in the United States District Courts, Manhattan, and District Court of Bhopal, India, against Union Carbide, now owned by Dow Chemical. Online to talk about this important issue and the 25th anniversary of this disaster is Don Wright from Amnesty International. Welcome to the show, Don.
Thank you very much.
Now, Union Carbide, now owned by Dow, has denied allegations on its website around this tragedy. The corporation believes that the accident was a result of sabotage by someone adding water into the system. Can you speak to this claim? What do we know 25 years later?
Well, there's no absolutely certain answer, but certainly the claim that it was sabotage doesn't absolve them of any responsibility for what happened next. There's no evidence that's been brought forward to really confirm that it was sabotage, but certainly, however it started, the fact is that so many of the safety systems were disabled or not working. There was no evacuation plan. There weren't trained staff on site that could deal with any kind of sabotage or accident or other incident. So everything else that's connected with this situation, with that incident, is the corporation's responsibility.
You're quite correct, Don. I grew up in an industrial area, and the plants had fail-safe mechanisms in case something went wrong. So has it been shown that Bhopal was negligent in putting those safety standards in place?
Absolutely. There was a very similar plant producing the same pesticides in Virginia, in the United States. And in the Virginia plant, it was absolutely state-of-the-art technology. There was an evacuation plan. It wasn't located anywhere near a residential area. It had highly trained staff, evacuation plans, safety plans, and much smaller holding tanks of chemicals. Whereas in Bhopal, they installed older technology. They had a much larger tank than would have been allowed to be in one place in the United States. And all of the, very little safety equipment and what was there that was supposed to be fail-safe, so if water ever was added to the MIC, there was supposed to be some safety equipment there, but all of it was either not functioning or disabled to save money. So there's supposed to be at least three steps before the gas would have been released that would have likely prevented it from being either quite as disastrous or even any release at all. And all those things were either disabled or not working. Clearly, the corporation is responsible for what happened.
Now, I want to come back to something. You know, there's allegations of 10,000 people dying within the first week. 25,000 have since died. Hundreds of tons of toxic chemicals abandoned. The social responsibility of any company that causes this kind of suffering is very high. Now, can you speak to Union Carbide's social responsibility? In 89, they made a settlement which paid out $470 million, which was basically insurance and interest, alleviating them of any further civic and criminal liability. To me, this seems outrageously, insultingly low. For example, I just did some research. I found where a construction worker on a U.S. highway was killed due to unsafe safety protections. His family was awarded $1 million, and that's one person. How is this possible? Is it because it's just in India, or is this kind of typical of companies, our companies, and the way they work overseas?
Well, indeed. And in fact, you know, definitely between 7,000 and 10,000 people died in the immediate aftermath. There's actually no one's questioning that number anymore. And we also know that about 10,000 to 15,000 people died over the next 15, 20 years after that. And people continue to die at a very high rate. But perhaps even more important is the huge number of people that continue to suffer health effects. And in fact, we have a whole generation of children being born in that area with severe deformities and health effects. And so the settlement that was arrived at very early in the process was based on a total of 3,000 deaths and, you know, very small number of chronic health issues. And you know, $470 million sounds like a big number to us. I mean, wow, that's a big number. But really, it worked out to about $1,000 per person who was at that moment diagnosed and could make a claim. Many actually settled for much less than that because they didn't understand that this was going to be a long-term health issue. People were told that, yeah, eventually the, you know, your lung issues and your eye problems will clear up, so, you know, don't worry about it. They were told that it was essentially a harmless toxic, you know, or harmless cloud that hit them, and that they would, you know, everything would clear up after a little while. So people didn't understand that, in fact, this was going to be a long-term health issue for them, and now we're seeing that it's a health issue for their children. And so the compensation has ended up being woefully inadequate, and we are calling for the government of India to deal with that, to make sure that there's a commission that was supposed to be established. I think it has been established now, but whether it's operating or not, I'm not clear. But to make sure that more resources are put into Bhopal to attend to, you know, essentially the long-term impact of this gas leak.
You're quite right. $1,000 per person is ridiculous. I know here, if my dog bites someone, they get a settlement of $2,000 to $4,000 for a dog bite. It's quite insulting. In 2004, the famous Yes Men played a hoax. They got on BBC News. They impersonated representatives from Dow Chemical, and they said they would be making full compensation to the Bhopal victims. Do you ever think there'll be a day when the people of Bhopal will get proper compensation from Dow Chemical?
It doesn't look likely, although we are calling for them to take responsibility. They continue to deny any further responsibility. So whether it was sabotage or not, they simply say it's not our problem anymore. The plant is now owned by the state, but it hasn't been cleaned up, and Dow won't clean it up, and there's no Union Carbide left to clean it up. So it's going to come down to the Indian government having probably to pay for it. But we are continuing to hold Dow responsible, and we're continuing to call on the U.S. to extradite Warren Anderson to India, where they have issued a new arrest warrant for his arrest, but the U.S. continues to refuse to turn him over. He's getting quite old now, so you know, the sooner the better for that process.
Why is this issue so important for organizations like Amnesty International? Of course, the human suffering is extremely important, but why is it important to people outside of India, people in Canada, people in the listening audience? Why should we pay attention to cases like this where these large corporations run away from a country after these kind of disasters?
Yeah, well, certainly there's a couple of reasons maybe that we should be concerned. One is we probably all have shares in Dow or similar kinds of companies that are committing human rights violations or who have been charged with various environmental human rights violations through our Canada Pension Plan, through other mutual funds and pension funds we have. So we need to be mindful that we actually are all invested in some of these companies. But perhaps more importantly, you know, it's about powerful corporate interests, legal complexities, and governments have failed to protect the rights of their citizens. And that is a global responsibility for all of us to be paying attention to. And particularly, you know, making sure that the grassroots organizations in Bhopal and in India have the resources and have the capacity and the space to be continuing to push for their rights. So it's not about all of us being able to give people in Bhopal their rights. It's about making sure it's safe and that they are being listened to when they are pushing for their rights on the ground in Bhopal. It's now affecting the next generation. And in fact, it's the next generation that are taking up the struggle and have been involved in protests in Bhopal and elsewhere to draw public attention to the fact that it's not just the people that were there in Bhopal at the time, but a whole new generation of children are being affected by this chemical leak. As you mentioned, or as we both mentioned, the plant is still sitting there and it's leaching all these chemicals into the ground, which has completely contaminated the water supply in the whole, you know, quite a few of the neighborhoods around Bhopal. Another reason for us to be calling for that plant to be cleared up. The standards in the U.S. at the plant they had in the U.S. were much tougher and stronger, and were more respectful of the rights of the people in the community versus the complete lack of respect for the community in Bhopal.
And your website is?
It's amnesty.ca, and you will find if you go to our amnesty.ca and look, pull down one of the menus, you will find some information about Bhopal, and we do have some information that you can use to write a letter to the government of India, and some information you can use to write a leter to the current chairman of Dow Chemical, and I'd really encourage people to do that.
Thanks again for joining us, Don Wright from Amnesty International.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was Don Wright of Amnesty International in conversation with Stuart and Sylvia Richardson of CJSF. Now is time for the week's health tip, and for that, we go to Sharon Hundle. Sharon?
Hi, everyone. So this week, I thought it'd be appropriate to talk about caffeine because with exams just around the corner, it seems to be popular among students who are getting ready for their long study sessions, and even the dreary days and cold weather can make us all feel a little sluggish, and that caffeine boost can be something we just rely on, and maybe a little bit too much. So I've got a three-step plan, which I adapted from the BC Dairy Foundation's brochure about caffeine consumption. It'll help you assess whether or not you're consuming a safe amount for all different age groups. Step one would be to estimate your current caffeine intake for one day. To do this, you have to think about the sources from which you get caffeine each day and find the milligrams of caffeine in them. I'll list a few in just like a second. Then write down the number of portions that you consume beside that source of caffeine. Simply multiply those numbers, then add them all up for a total estimate of what you consume in one day. So where does caffeine even come from? Basically, there are a ton of different sources. We usually think of tea and coffee as being the main ones, but caffeine can be found in things like beverages, all types of them, chocolate, and even medication like certain stimulants have about 50% more caffeine than one cup of brewed coffee. So one cup of brewed coffee has about 100 milligrams. One shot of espresso has about half of that, 65 to 85 milligrams, which is standard for most small lattes. A cup of brewed black tea is much less, only 50 milligrams, and it's important to note that herbal teas do not contain caffeine at all. Chocolate milk and hot chocolate does have a little bit, about 5 milligrams in one cup, and a cup of energy drink also has about 80 milligrams, so that's pretty high. Believe it or not, chocolate cake and solid chocolate could have between 10 to 25 milligrams for a small piece, too. So after figuring out roughly how much caffeine you'd have in a usual day, how much is too much? That's the big question. So step two is to consider recommended maximum daily caffeine intakes for different age groups. Current research suggests that an intake of 400 to 450 milligrams of caffeine per day poses no risk to healthy adults. If you're worried about the little ones that are like 4 to 6 years old, 45 milligrams is okay. That would be like 9 cups of hot chocolate, which is quite a lot. For kids 7 to 9 years old, 60 milligrams is okay as a maximum. And for a higher age group of like 10 to 12 year olds, 85 milligrams is recommended as maximum. For women of childbearing age, it's a little less than the average adult maximum, about 300 milligrams is recommended as the caffeine max per day. And for most adults, like I said earlier, 400 to 450 milligrams is all right. So double-check to see if your daily caffeine intake is in check. And we're almost done, so your step three, which is your last step, is to take action. If you found that things are out of balance, select one idea for action that you can realistically accomplish. Replacing an afternoon latte with a cup of steamed milk is just one example to kind of lower your caffeine intake per day. So to hear these details once again, please check out our podcast and shows on our website at citr.ca. And for more info on anything health and wellness related, please visit the UBC Wellness Center on the UBC campus. So good luck, everyone. Stay happy and healthy over the winter break and enjoy your holidays. I'll be back in the new year to share more health info and tips with you. Thanks, Carrie.
Thanks, Sharon. And now for Thunderbird Eye on Sports, here's Tyler Noble.
All right, thank you very much, Carrie. The UBC Thunderbirds men's hockey team, the only team in action tonight as the first half of the Canada West season comes to a close. The Thunderbirds closed their first half of the regular season with a two-game homestand against the Calgary Dinos at Father Bauer Arena. Game time 7:30. You can hear the game right here on CITR. The Thunderbirds will be out for revenge as the Dinos swept UBC by scores of 4-1 and 4-0 last weekend. The pair of wins by Calgary gave them a firm grip on fourth place in the Canada West standings. That's the final playoff spot. And they're just 2 points back of Manitoba for second in the conference. But UBC is now fighting to get back in the playoff race as they're 9 points back for that final playoff spot. They are chasing the Dinos. UBC has just one win in their last 10 games, with scoring woes proving to be a major issue during this stretch. UBC opened the season averaging 4 goals per game over their first 5 contests, but they have scored more than 2 goals just twice since then. Justin McCray and Brandon Campos leading the offensive effort with 11 points apiece. However, that ranked them only tied for 25th in league scoring. UBC has also struggled a bit in goal. Veteran Francois Thuot has been replaced a little bit in the last little while. Jordan White, the rookie, has earned a pair of starts over the past 3 games, including the Birds' 4-3 win over Lethbridge a couple of weeks ago. But Thuot has seen the bulk of the time between the posts and has a 3.91 goals against average and an .864 save percentage. UBC obviously needing wins in a hurry. Otherwise, it's going to be a very long Christmas break for them as they look at Mount Everest on the other side to try and come back into the playoff picture. Other teams are all off, but some news still to report. The UBC Thunderbirds men's basketball team and women's volleyball team topped their respective national top 10 polls this week. The men's basketball team a return to the top spot after a brief stint during last year's season, while the two-time defending national champion women's volleyball squad has led the rankings the entire year. They're a perfect 9-0 so far. Men's basketball, they're ranked behind the reigning champion Carleton Ravens in the first 4 polls of the season. The 7-0 Thunderbirds climb up to number 1 in the final rankings of this semester. The Birds lost to Carleton in last year's CIS final. This year, they have received 41 of 42 first place votes in this week's top 10 and improved to that 7-0 mark over the weekend. Last weekend, that is, with a pair of dominating road wins in Winnipeg, defeating the Westmen 89-54 and then the Manitoba Bisons 93-75 last Saturday. As for the women's volleyball team, they go into the December break with an unblemished 9-0 conference mark, as I mentioned, thanks to a straight set victory over Simon Fraser last Friday. The Birds have dropped just only 2 sets in all of their 9 matches and have been the top-ranked team in the nation since week 1. Their schedule will get a little bit tougher in 2010. As a squad, the Birds lead the Canada West in hitting percentage, opponent hitting percentage, assists, kills, blocks, and they're second in service aces. A bit of an opposite story for the men's volleyball team, though. They're 1-7 thus far, 9th in the conference out of 10 teams. They're 2.5 matches back of Winnipeg for 7th and the final playoff spot there. As for women's basketball, they're 5-3 through the first half of the season. That's 2nd in the Pacific Division. They trail Simon Fraser, which is a perfect 8-0 so far. And the women's hockey team head into the break on quite the roll themselves. They're now 5-6-1, good for 4th in the conference and the final playoff spot for them. 4-game win streak, including a couple of wins last weekend on home ice against the Regina Cougars. So some optimism for some of the teams and a big hill to climb for the other teams, Kerry, heading into 2010. That's your Thunderbird Eye on Sports. I'm Tyler Noble.
Thanks, Tyler. And now for a look at your weekend weather, here's Denise Stiatic.
The days are sunny and bright, and the frost is steadily creeping in. I hope this beautiful week has kept your spirits up this last week of classes. We should have some sun going into exams as well. Here's your forecast for the weekend of December 4th through 6th. an upper trough of low pressure over the interior of BC will transform into a closed upper over Vancouver. On the east side of this upper ridge of high pressure, there will be a strong northerly flow pushing cold Arctic air southwards. Thus, the weather is expected to be mainly sunny and cold. Tonight will be mostly clear with a low of negative 3 degrees. Saturday will be mostly sunny, windy at times, with a high of 3 degrees and a low of negative 5. Sunday will be mostly sunny and occasionally windy, with a high of negative 1 and a low of negative 7. That's your forecast for the weekend, brought to you by the Storm Club of UBC. Best of luck on your exams. Currently, it's 4 degrees and clear at YVR. For News 101, I'm Denise Diotic.
And that's our program for December 4th, 2009. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Megan Turcotta produced this radio program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 for the next edition of News 101. I'm Carrie Baptist. For the entire news team here at CITR, thanks for listening, and stay tuned for Hot Mess here on CITR 101.9 FM.